Thank you, Tim. Kirsten and I had sort of a strange courtship. Sorry, Kirsten, I didn't ask you for permission, but I'm hoping. What's new? In that, from the moment that we realized that we had fallen in love with one another, we realized that we were living 5,000 miles apart from each other. And then we were married 13 months later. And in those 13 months, we spent about 5 weeks' time together. It's not something that we would necessarily recommend to all folks. It is certainly not the way of many couples nowadays who spend a lot of time together before they make that commitment to one another. But Kirsten and I, as you know, are a little bit strange. And so it was August of 1987 that we realized that we had fallen in love with each other, and then we saw each other at Thanksgiving and at Christmas, and in February at Valentine's Day, meeting halfway between Washington, D.C. and Hawaii, we got engaged in San Francisco, and 7 months later, we were married. And so many of the things that we had to learn about one another, that many couples learn by spending time with one another, we actually spent that time with one another after we had made a commitment of marriage to each other. So on our honeymoon, we were beginning to learn stuff about each other that we didn't really know. Kirsten and I had the marvelous gift of being able to charter a bare boat and sail in the Abacos Islands in the Bahamas, which ironically is right now in the eye of the storm with 180-mile-an-hour winds in the very places that we were sailing 31 years ago. Tuesday is not just a birthday day, it's also an anniversary day for Kirsten and myself. And we went out to go sailing, and on our very first night going sailing, it made sense that we should do this. I'm a boy who had lived by the sea all my life. I loved the sea. Kirsten is a woman who had sailed for years, had been the first mate on the tall ship of Miami. She knew what she was doing in a sailboat. I was comfortable with the ocean. It felt good. We're out sailing, and we're just going to go a very short distance until we can moor an anchor. Simple task. Kirsten is at the helm. I didn't know a word like helm at the time. I was at the bow, didn't know a word like that at the time. And she is giving me instructions on how to lay the anchor, do something with lines, and do all sorts of stuff. And she's yelling at me about ports and starboards, and I don't know any of this. But what we realize is, you know how when the person's having a hard time understanding you, what do? We talk louder. So she's beginning to talk louder, and what she did not know about me, because we hadn't spent a whole lot of time together, is that when you talk louder to me, I get very agitated, and I can become somewhat angry. Definitely I could seethe, and that seething can last for a long time. And so she's talking louder at me. I have no idea what she wants me to do, and we're going to sail by this mooring. Here's the good news. One, we did anchor. Two, it was our honeymoon, so we found other ways to work things out. But three, even better, is 31 years later, we have learned to speak each other's language. And Kirsten knows at times, she can know in ways that others won't know when that seething is beginning to happen. She knows when the chaos that is a part of my life, may become a part of my life, is about to erupt. And she knows, and most of the time knows to do this, knows to be able to talk to me in a certain way or remove me from the situation or whatever it is, so that chaos need not erupt. It is a language that is not necessarily words. It is a language that comes from connection with one another. It is a language that comes from relationship with one another. It is a language that comes from love for one another. It is a language that allows us to know, after these years together, how to be with one another in calm and peaceful ways most of the time, right? And though it may seem strange, I think that is exactly what the scripture, what Tim just read for us of the story of Jesus there out on the boat with the disciples, is all about. It is Jesus speaking a language of love. Now, it's not a language of love with the boys that are there in the boat with him. It is a language of love instead with the elements of the world that are swirling around him. It's a language of intimacy. It's a language of connectivity. It's a language of relationship. And I understand very well when I read the story of Jesus going out in the boat, why it is that he chose to go out in the boat at that time. If you read Luke chapter 7 and Luke chapter 8, all that precedes this moment, the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, you understand that these are heady and wild times. Jesus is challenging the status quo left and right. He's letting women into his group. He's letting women come and anoint him with perfume and oil. He's letting tax collectors and sinners come and be part of his group. There are stories that are going on left and right, metaphors and parables. There's healing, nonstop healing that is going forth. And you have the sense that people are coming to him. They're saying, feed me, help me, heal me. I need you. And there's this need that he has, clearly, human as he is, to get away from all of that that is coming at him. What he has unleashed into the world is coming back at him in need from all these folks. And so he hears the call of the sea. He knows the lapping of the waves on the bow of the boat. He understands the gentle furling in the sail that takes them deeper into the water. He understands the fragrant, the mist that is coming. And he knows that this is a place that there is calm and rest. I think about the story that many of us may have read to our children, The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. And what I love about that story, although I have some issues with it, but what I love about that story is that the interplay between the apple tree and the young boy is the apple tree knows what the young boy wants. And the apple tree says, come, boy, come play. Come, boy, come rest. Come, boy, come take the weight of the world off of your shoulders. Be here with me. And I suspect that is exactly the voice that Jesus knows that he needs to hear, and the sea is speaking to him, saying, come, come, boy, come rest, come play. Most of us here living so close to the ocean know that voice very well. I was privileged a number of years ago to spend many times on the island of Lanai. I led retreats there. I led camping trips there of folks visiting. I took friends there. The weekend before I started my ministry at Kapa'a UCC, I went on a solo retreat on the island of Lanai, always at Hulupoi Beach, Manele Bay. And I understand that call of the sea, because as soon as I would get there, even if I had responsibilities with all these people I was leading, I could not wait to get into the ocean. I could not wait to grab my mask, snorkel, and fins, and I had this reality that I had to do, as I would dive into the ocean there, and I would dive down at about 10 feet, grab sand, let the sand come through my hands, blow bubbles, go through the bubbles, come up, take a breath of air, go back through, and dance and pirouette in the water, just so alive, knowing that the ocean was saying, come boy, come play, come be. Let all that responsibility that's on the beach, it can wait. Just come here and be with me. And then slowly I would begin to turn around, and there would be my neighbors of the fish of the shallow reef over here, the neighbors of the deeper reef over there. Every now and then there would be the gift of the dolphin that would swim in, and I would be able to be with them. Come, boy. Come play. Allow. And the ocean would speak to me and call me, just in the same way that I believe the ocean is calling, the Sea of Galilee, is calling to Jesus. We who live here, we know this. We know that sense of the ocean that calls to us. We know that sense that for our Hawaiian brothers and sisters, if you look at their mele, their songs, their ole, their chants, if you look at the olelo, their stories, you hear the ocean alive through all of that. You hear the ocean as something animate. It is not static. It is not just a place where there is H2O. It is this alive entity. It is not at all dissimilar to what we hear from what Tim read to us from Psalm 104. If you reread that psalm, you hear this motion of the waters that God has created that begin with the ocean and finds a way to the mountaintop and flow in from Malka to Makai, and you have this sense of movement. It's not just H2O working its way down the moon. There is aliveness in that movement. And in that movement, there's time where it pauses and waters the land, times where it pauses and gives nourishment to the animals. And that water moves. It's in the Hebrew Bible. That which God has created, all the creation that surrounds us, is alive, is animate. You look at, for instance, you look at Isaiah 55. It says, you shall go out in joy and be led in peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth into singing, and the trees of the field shall all be clapping. Let the heavens rejoice, Psalm 96 says. Let the earth be glad. Let the sea resound and all that is it. Let the fields be jubilant and everything in them. Let all the trees of the forest sing for joy, or Job. But ask the animals, all of creation, and they will teach you. The birds of the sky, they will tell you, if you speak to the earth, it will teach you. Or let the fish of the sea inform you. In the Hebrew Bible, the Bible that Jesus is embedded in, what he knows, the creation is alive. Utterly and totally alive. Our Hawaiian brothers and sisters knew this long before there was ever Western contact. They understood the ocean as something that was utterly alive. When the voyagers went from island to island, they did not sail across the sea. They did not sail across this static thing. And they understood instead that the sea itself, alive, moved under them and helped to guide them to where they needed to be. They didn't understand in that wonderful Polynesian triangle from Hawaii to Aotearoa to Rapa Nui, where all of the islands of Polynesia are found. They didn't understand that the ocean kept them apart from one another, but the ocean was connective tissue that allowed them to indeed be connected to one another and to all of God's creation. Robin Wall Kimmerer, the author of the book Braiding Sweetgrass, talks about this, and she says it's the language of animancy, the language of a creation that is animated, a creation that is alive. She tells this wonderful story in the book. She is Native American woman. She comes from the Potawatomi. Thank you. I've practiced that so many times. Potawatomi tribe. And she speaks about learning as an adult how to speak her language that was the language of her people. At the time that she began to learn, there were only 9 native Potawatomi speakers left in the world. 9. And so she was determined to become one that could understand and speak the language. And so she was a botanist. And she says, this can't be that hard. I'm so used to, I know the common word for a plant, and I know the Latin word for a plant. You just replace one with the other. So I know the English word that we would use in this situation, and the Potawatomi word obviously will be its equivalent, except for she discovered that Potawatomi is a language in which 70% of the words are verbs. Think about that. We have a language, speaking English, in which only 30% or so of the language is verbs. Actually, less than that. 70% of our language is nouns. So what happens when you're trying to translate hill, and in English it says, there is a hill, but in Potawatomi it says, to be a hill. Or Saturday, today is Saturday or Sunday, and instead the translation is to be Sunday. And the word that really hung her up was the word in Potawatomi for the word bay. And she's looking at it, and it says the Potawatomi is to be a bay. And she goes, what do you mean, to be a bay? To be a bay. A bay is a bay. It's a bay. There it is, right there. Look at it on the map. There's a bay. How can it be anything? How can it be a verb? It's a bay. And then she says, and I love this, she's such a powerful writer, read the book. Read the book. Go home today, buy it, read the book. Best book I've read all year. Braiding Sweetgrass, Robin Wall Kimmerer. Read the book.
I won't have to preach the rest of the year. Just read the book. But she writes about, she says, at the moment that she says, a bay is a bay is a bay is a bay, she says, all of a sudden I could feel the synapses firing in my brain, and they were going left and right, and they were working their way down my arms and working my way to my toes. And she writes, she says, a bay is only a bay if the water is dead. When a bay is a noun, it is defined by humans trapped between its shores and contained by the word. But the word in Potawatomi, wikikwama, no, I ruined that. To be a bay, not a bay, but to be a bay releases the water from bondage and lets it live. To be a bay held the wonder that for this very moment, the living water has decided to shelter itself between these shores, conversing with cedar roots and a flock of baby mergansers, because it could do otherwise. It could become a stream or an ocean or a waterfall, and there are verbs for that too. To be a hill, to be a sandy beach, to be a Saturday, all are possible verbs in a world where everything is alive. Where everything is alive. Imagine the conversations that we would be having in our world that Kirsten referred to so much as being such a divisive place right now. If the conversations that we were having about climate, if the conversations that we were having about the Amazon on fire, if the conversations we were having about coral reefs being threatened, if the conversations we were having about up on Mauna Kea, if all these conversations began with an understanding that that which we are talking about is animate, is alive, is a creation of God's, and the breath of God flows through it. How different might those conversations be than if we are having a conversation in which all those things are simply resources for our utilization? And I am convinced that that is the world. That is the world that Jesus lived in. That is the world that Jesus lived in. In that he lived in a world in which he understood he was in conversation with this amazingly animated creation, with all of its parts, from the Mauka top to the Makai, to that which is below the sea and that which surrounds, that all of that was indeed alive. Kirsten and I spent Friday and Saturday on Hawaii Island. You have to be tone deaf to the creation to not understand that the creation is alive when you are on Hawaii Island. We spent Friday in Pahoa driving down the road to where the road ends because there is a volcano cinder cone right there in the middle of the road where once there were 700 homes, there is nothing but lava expanse in front of you. And you go and step onto the properties and you recognize that the land is still warm, that it is still venting, that you have a hard time breathing in places because of the sulfur that is there. When you're in Pahoa, when you're in the southern Puna area, you know that this island is alive. Creation is moving. You can practically feel the lava moving underneath you, even though it may be thousands of feet below you. You know that it is a lot. And then yesterday we spent most of the day on Mauna Kea. We were there for the noontime protocol with the protectors there at Mauna Kea. And we were there and we spent, as Kirsten said, we spent a lot of time listening to a lot of voices. As I shared with the adult ed, it just so happened that we were staying in a B&B owned by the person who is the director of Volcano Support Service, or the Mauna Kea Support Services. So he's responsible for the roads being open. He's responsible for the work that goes on, making sure that telescopes can operate and all of that. So he clearly had a very different perspective of what was going on Mauna Kea than the protectors that we went and spent time with. And so we were getting bombarded left and right with all sorts of conversations and all sorts of well-meaning, heart-impassioned thoughts. But what struck me as we were on the mountain is the following. The mountain, the Mauna, was alive. The Mauna was so clearly alive, so clearly when you hear Robin Wall Kimmerer speak about the language of animacy, the language of the creation being alive and having its own set of being, that was true. Because as we watched in the morning, the Mauna of the late morning, a blue sky and green hills, would change to the Mauna of the midday, clouds filling the air, tears of rain clouds, voices of thunder, the Mauna of the late afternoon, clouded with the clouds coming back, roving, awaiting the end of the day, receiving the sun in its last rays, and the Mauna of the night filled with clarity and wonder. The Mauna was not a static place. It's not just a place where rocks gathered together. It was a living, breathing entity, and we were honored and privileged to be present there on the Mauna. Forget where the issues are. Just imagine the conversation about those issues if the conversation begins with understanding that as a living, breathing entity that is part of our life. I don't know the Hebrew words, how many are nouns and pronouns like in Potawatomi. I don't know that for sure, but I do know that the language that Jesus spoke is very similar to the language that was being spoken there on the mountain, a language of a connectivity to what God has created. I know it is the language that needs to become our language, not just our language here in this space of Church of the Crossroads, but the language of a community. If we are going to work our way through the struggles that we face with a climate in crisis, with an ocean that is struggling with so many things, if we are going to work our way through, we must speak a language where we understand that the creation has a voice as well. I realize that every day on my day off when I realize what I love to do is go hiking. I realize it every day when I'm writing a sermon and what I do is I go walking. I realize that the reason that I do that is I am going to be with my ohana, be with my kin, be with those who are around me, the mountains, the sea, the plants, the birds, who will speak to me, who will inspire me, who will allow me to learn lessons that if I just stick my head in a book, I will never know. Will I ever have the fluency of that language with creation that Jesus had, where he is able to be on the boat, and when the creation decides that it wants to get stormy, he is able to say, stop, we're not going there? I doubt it. This is Jesus after all, right? So we kind of expect that he would have that ability. I don't think I'm ever going to have that fluency, but can I have the knowledge of the language to be able to say when the storms happen, to say, what it is that you want to tell me? What is it I need to know? What am I doing in our relationship with all that God has created so as to create these storms, to create the need for the venting that comes from it? What are we doing? Can we have that language? Can we have that wisdom to listen in the same way that Jesus on the boat welcomed into the sea, come boy, come play. And when the sea changed its tenor, was able to respond as well as one that speaks intimately? Can we have that intimacy of relationship with God's creation? I am convinced that when Jesus gives us the command that we are indeed to love our neighbors as ourselves, that Jesus is talking about a far bigger neighborhood than most of us think about. That the neighborhood that we typically think about is the neighborhood of those that look like us, that have the eyes like us, have the bodies like us, that these are our neighbors. But I believe that when Jesus talks about love your neighbors, that neighborhood is much bigger. That neighborhood has those who are four-pawed and those who are finned. That neighborhood has those that are leafed, those that are filled with polyps. That neighborhood has those that are clouds and mountains and rivers and streams. That neighborhood is all of those. And when God says when Jesus calls us to love our neighbors as ourselves, the love is not just for those who look like us. The love is for the entirety of God's creation. So when we know and we gather around this table, and we gather at this place and we remember that last night in which Jesus is together with his with his disciples, and they are together, and he says to them, you know, I'm about to give of myself that all might have life, and I'm going to call you to do the same, to be willing to give of yourselves, that all who might have life goes beyond those who look just like us. The all who might have life is the entirety of God's creation. They may not have been able to anticipate 2,000 years ago the crisis that the creation might be in. But that doesn't mean that that call was not embedded. That call is embedded and we need to hear it. So when God calls us to love our neighbors, that neighborhood includes all that we have been blessed to be part of. That neighborhood includes those that speak a language that is not a language that we hear with our ears, but instead a language that we hear with our hearts and with our spirits. It's a language that is sometimes saying, come, come play. And other times these days is saying, come, come help. Love. Be love. Be love with all that God has created. And so we remember that on that night, the night in which he was betrayed, Jesus was gathered with his family, with his friends, with his ohana. And he took bread and he broke it. And he said, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In remembrance of me is the giving of our own life that others might have life. And in the same fashion, he took the cup and he poured it into the cup and he said, this cup is the cup of salvation poured to you for the forgiveness of sins. And in the forgiveness of sins, I mean, what a wonderful gift that we are forgiven. But in that forgiving, there is an expectation that as we are forgiven, so shall we live as those who have been forgiven, that we shall live in a new way. We shall live in a way that is reciprocal and loving with one another, that we shall embody that forgiveness. And so we take this cup of salvation knowing that we are called to be that salvation for one another and for this entire created world, to be part of that journey together. So ministering in his name, I present to you the elements of the table. Come, the table is set, and all are welcome. Amen.